Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And tonight our guest is Barbara Lowe Fisher, and she's with the Vaccine Center back in Washington, D.C., and she's been on the front lines of really what's happening as far as the use of vaccines and their advantages and disadvantages for many years. Of course, many people look and see the doing away with childhood diseases as really a wonderful and remarkable thing responsible for improving the health of our children, and to an extent it really has. Certainly we don't see the measles and the mumps and the chicken pox and the poliomyelitis and the other things that we used to see, but what about the trade-off? What How do we explain the fact that one in six American children has a neurodevelopmental abnormality or a behavioral abnormality? Why is it that some people estimate that one in six children has asthma or a tendency towards asthma, and the rising of allergies and autoimmune disease and childhood diabetes? And well, these questions are asked, but nobody seems to have any answers to them. And are we really helping children when we vaccinate them and change the means by which they obtain childhood diseases, which in most instances are not life-threatening? Well, to answer that question and address the issues and what's really happening today, Barbara, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Stan, for having me.
Well, tell us what the current status is. You know, you've been how long have you been in this battle?
For 23 years.
That's a long, long time. And it really got into it when your son got his DPT shot and became autistic. Was that it?
He did not become autistic. He was left with minimal brain damage that took the form of multiple learning disabilities and attention deficit disorder. That was in 1980. The vaccine that did that was the DPT shot, the whole cell pertussis vaccine in the old DPT shot we used to use. Before parents got together and lobbied Congress and put pressure on the health agencies to purify the vaccine. We now have a DTAP vaccine, acellular pertussis, which is purified but still can cause cases of brain inflammation like my son suffered within 4 hours of his DPT shot. No vaccine is perfectly safe or perfectly effective. In fact, we do have a number of vaccine failures. We also have quite a few reactions, injuries, and deaths following vaccination that are largely undiagnosed and ignored or pushed under the carpet by physicians, I think, who are in denial and don't want to recognize that when children regress after vaccination, when they lose skills, when they become chronically ill, that it could have something to do with the shots that they had been given by pediatricians.
Well, I think that, you know, as a physician, I can tell you, you're always sort of defensive. You would never intentionally want to hurt anybody. And then when somebody comes back after you've done something that you thought was going to be helpful, and the parent tells the doctor that the patient is worse, that the child is worse, or beginning to develop some problems, you know, I understand why they're defensive, but we have to be objective, too. And if what we're doing is not helping, or is certainly in some instances making things worse, then we have to be willing to accept it. But certainly there have been some changes in recent years, and when we get back, we want to talk really about what the concerned parents were able to do as far as getting the mercury out of the childhood vaccines. And even though that the government has taken the mercury out of the childhood vaccines for children here, they've put it into the influenza vaccine for children, and we're still giving the mercury-laden vaccines to children throughout the rest of the world. So why did they take it out here and leave it in for the rest of the children? Well, Barbara, where should we start? Do you want to start with the thimerosalin vaccines, or what would you like to talk about?
Well, the thing is, we're all very concerned and need to be concerned about the thimerosal preservative mercury, which is a mercury derivative in vaccines, and that certainly has been in the news in the past year or so, or a few years even. But I think what's important to remember is mercury is not the only problem with vaccines, and I do have some concern that with the focus on mercury, the public is beginning to believe that if you just take the mercury out, we have mercury-free vaccines, we will no longer have any vaccine-associated regression into chronic illness and disability. And I personally don't think that's true. I mean, I've been around long enough to see that with every few years, there is a new issue regarding vaccine safety. When I began this work in 1982, it was the whole cell DPT vaccine, the P part or whooping cough part of the DPT vaccine. But over the years, there have been a number of concerns raised about vaccine safety. The hepatitis B vaccine that was recommended in 1991 for babies only 12 hours of age in the newborn nursery, MMR vaccine associated with the development of autism, chronic inflammation and autism, was really the first vaccine to be associated with autism. We've had concerns about pneumococcal vaccine that was licensed in the early 2000s. So mercury in vaccines is the latest to hit the news, but it's not the last that will hit the news, and it's not the only problem that we have with vaccines.
And I'm sure you're absolutely right. What about the aluminum that has always been in vaccines, the alum that they use in adjuvant? Is there some potential danger to that as well?
Well, I think certainly any time you have something that is known to be toxic to the brain or known to cause immune dysfunction when humans are exposed to it, and there's no question mercury and aluminum are two of those, you don't want that to be in any product you inject into the human body. Why aluminum is still part of vaccines is, it just is a question, particularly when, like mercury, it really has not been rigorously studied for its in vaccines for its effect on the human body. I was just noticing in the drugstore the other day when I was shopping that somebody has now developed an aluminum-free deodorant. As we all know, deodorants have had aluminum in them, and aluminum has been associated with Alzheimer's disease.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment, please, Barbara, as we go to our, bring our stations up. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Barbara Lowe Fisher from the Vaccine Center back in Washington. And we were just talking about the other problems. Of course, everybody talks about the mercury in vaccines, but Barbara was simply pointing out that the initial problem was the fact that they used the whole pertussis vaccine, although they've come up with an acellular pertussis vaccine, this is still producing brain damage in a certain number of children. And then the issue with MMR, and then there's been a vaccine, and then there's certainly been a concern about the pneumococcal vaccine. And, of course, then I raised the issue of aluminum in vaccines, and Barbara was saying that she is concerned that they would put anything toxic that is known to be neurotoxic, whether it be mercury or aluminum, because aluminum is known to be toxic. Why are they putting it in the vaccines that they're giving to our children? So she was just talking about how she'd been to a drugstore recently, and there they had a deodorant, and they advertised it as aluminum-free. Why? Well, because people know that heavy metals, or aluminum at least, is associated with Alzheimer's disease and damage to the brain, and everybody knows that. So the question then Barbara was raising is, why would you put something like that into a vaccine that you're giving to newborn children or very, very young children? You pick up the story from there, Barbara.
Right. I think that I remember when I was using eye contact solution back in the 70s and 80s, they went to mercury-free eye contact solution because so many people were having toxic reactions, eye irritation, etc. I mean, thimerosal preservatives, mercury derivatives, were being taken off out of the over-the-counter products long before the issue of mercury in vaccines started to be discussed publicly. And yet the public health agencies and the drug companies are insisting that thimerosal in vaccines has nothing to do with the rise of developmental disabilities that we're seeing our children experience. I think that mercury is part of the reason that we're having an epidemic of chronic disease and disability in our children that has occurred in the last 20 years at precisely the same time as we've nearly doubled the numbers of doses of vaccines our children get in the first 5 years of life. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that the idea that you can engage in an unlimited manipulation of the immune system, which in this case is an artificial manipulation of the immune system, because you are atypically introducing into the body viruses, lab-altered viruses and bacteria through the process of vaccination. Why would one presume that there would be no downside whatsoever in doing that? We have never done that to human beings ever. It's only been in the last 50 years that we have manipulated the immune system this way in early childhood. The other thing we've done is we've totally eliminated the natural experience of infection, these childhood diseases that we've experienced for for a long time humans have experienced. We've totally eliminated the ability of the child to have an experience with acute infection in childhood. You know, what we're doing potentially is the immune system in not allowing it to mature in the same way that children have in the past may also be a part of the reason we're seeing a rise in chronic disease and disability in our kids. And, you know, I just, when I started to do this research to see what exactly does this look like, this rise in chronic disease and disability, I'll just give you an example. In 1970, autism affected 4 in 10,000 American children. Today, the CDC says 1 child in 166 in America is autistic and 1 in 6 is developmentally delayed. That is an unbelievable statistic, that 1 in 6 American children is developmentally delayed. If you look at something like the chronic disease asthma, in 1979, there were 2 million children with asthma in America, and today the government reports there are 9 million children with asthma. In 1976, we had about 796,000 learning disabled children in U.S. public schools, and now the CDC says there are about 3 million learning disabled children in public schools. ADHD, in 1997, affected 1.6 million American elementary school children, and today the CDC says there are 4 million children diagnosed with ADHD. You see, these are really astonishing figures. And we have to demand that our public health officials who are in charge of protecting the public health tell us why our children, so many of our children, are stuck on sick. I think it's because we are over-vaccinating our children and setting them up for chronic disease and disability.
Well, now I've heard that the veterinarians, or at least some veterinarians, are very concerned because they're, giving so many different types of vaccines to the animals. And we know that they tick the thimerosal. A lot of the vaccines were given to animals long ago. It's only been very recently they've taken it out of the vaccines that we're giving to our children. But, you know, have you heard that the veterinarians were concerned about over-vaccination?
No question. The veterinarians have understood this long before the pediatricians are willing to understand that there is too much vaccination going on. They are now pulling way back on vaccinating cats and dogs with so many vaccines, particularly simultaneously on the same day giving these animals so many vaccines. I think it's very interesting to see the veterinarians taking care of the pets of families, being proactive and stopping this practice long before the pediatricians are even willing to acknowledge that there may be a problem. This past weekend I joined with Kathy Williams and I, who are with the National Vaccine Information Center, joined with other parents of autistic children in demonstrating in front of the American Academy of Pediatrics at the D.C. Convention Hall. They were holding their annual conference, and we were asking the pediatricians, members of that organization, which makes policy recommendations regarding vaccines, we've asked them to please stop turning away from what's happening to children after vaccination. I mean, their theory is that if anything bad happens after vaccination to a child, it's only a coincidence. It's not in any way related to the vaccination. Well, this kind of putting your head in the sand is not doing our children any good. I mean, these doctors, we trust these doctors. We trust them with our children's lives when we take them in to those offices. And, you know, they are not, the doctors they're angry with parents who ask questions about vaccines. They're kicking parents out of their offices. There was a recent survey done that says almost 40% of pediatricians in this country are kicking parents out and denying children medical care if the parents attempt to make voluntary, informed decisions about vaccination and don't go exactly with what the doctor says, the exact schedule, using the exact vaccines the doctor says the child must have. This isn't any way to provide medical care. This doesn't demonstrate a true caring for the children of this country.
I really think, Barbara, that, you know, what they do and the way they manipulate the doctors, they say they're against us. I mean, here we are trying to help the children, and those crazy people are out there, and they're against us. And so we've got to stand together, and unfortunately, many of them simply go along to get along, And if you're a pediatrician, you try to buck, you know, the hierarchy that wants vaccination, they're going to make your life pretty miserable.
That's very true. I have watched in the last two decades physicians who step out of line and speak out about the problems of vaccines. I've watched them be destroyed. I've watched eminent scientists and really bright young physicians who want to do the right thing have their careers cut short because they have been brave enough and smart enough to try to stand up. But the problem is that there is a serious erosion of trust that's beginning in the minds and the hearts of parents of many children now. They're afraid of their pediatricians. They don't trust their pediatricians. They don't want to take their children in. And I think if pediatricians continue to take this hardline stance and listen to their leaders at the American Academy of Pediatrics and the public health officials who want to achieve a 100% vaccination rate in this country and take away all exemptions and all ability for the people to make voluntary informed decisions about vaccination, you are going to see people not going to doctors. You're going to see an underground developing. People are going to, they will not take their children in because doctors are reporting parents for child medical neglect and child abuse when they don't get their children all these vaccines. And you ought to see the vaccines coming. There are more than 200 vaccines that are being developed for everything, from cancer to the common cold. The next vaccine that's going to be on the market is the human papillomavirus vaccine, HPV vaccine, to supposedly protect against cervical cancer. They're recommending that both teenage boys and teenage girls get this vaccine, which this disease is basically like hepatitis B. It's sexually transmitted. But they are going to increasingly target adolescents for a number of these vaccines. So you're going to have the little babies, the newborn babies, the toddlers, the children up to age 5, and then you're going to hit them again at adolescence. Then they're instituting an adult vaccination program. And my prediction is that they're going to attach societal punishments for not going along with the program, which means you will basically not be able to function in society if you cannot prove that you've gotten all the government-recommended vaccines.
But, you know, this is a gigantic social experiment. I mean,
there is
no precedent because they don't know what's going to happen 20 years down the line with the human papilloma vaccine any more than they knew when I was practicing medicine and started out what was going to happen 20 years down the line when they gave women who were having a miscarriage large doses of estrogen. Of course, 20 years later, they found that their daughters had carcinoma of the vagina and had to have radical surgery and certainly destroy the reproductive. It took 20 years to find out that made a terrible, terrible error. So when we get back, we're going to be talking with Barbara Lowe Fisher really about what's going on today. And specifically, want to talk a little bit about hepatitis B vaccine being given to children, a massive social experiment. They're using your children as guinea pigs, and, well, we'll talk a little bit about the dramatic danger, very real danger, from this vaccine. Well, Barbara, why don't you, maybe we could touch on hepatitis B vaccine, because certainly this is one of my concerns, especially when you're giving it to an infant in the nursery, you know, when they really have such an immature immunological system, and they really are incapable of even developing a normal immune response. And what impact does that have on their immature body, this insult of actually challenging their immune system within the first few hours of their birth? Oh, do we have any idea of the complications that come from hepatitis B vaccine?
I know you have been concerned about this since this was made a policy in 1991. And I have been concerned too, because as you know, as a physician, you know almost nothing about a baby in the first 12 hours of life. You don't really know what the immune and neurological system, the health of that baby is. And yet you're giving that infant their first immunological experience through an atypical introduction into the body of hepatitis B virus.
Well, I'm really not giving the virus. You're giving a gene that comes from
correct.
The virus.
Correct. It's a recombinant DNA vaccine. It's the first recombinant DNA vaccine that we've used. That's right. But it's I mean, it's counterintuitive to think that you need to do that within 12 hours of birth when the baby has just emerged from the womb. And so, you know, we have reports of a number of babies dying, infants dying after hepatitis B vaccination, but their deaths are written off as sudden infant death syndrome. This is the same thing that happened with DPT vaccine. A number of the pertussis vaccine-induced deaths were written off as SIDS. I think 12 hours of age, the only babies who are truly at risk are those born to hepatitis B-infected mothers. We've always had a very low incidence of hepatitis B in this country, even before the vaccine was ever introduced. It's a disease that's basically sexually transmitted and is prevalent in IV drug users. So, you know, to have all healthy newborn babies born to healthy mothers vaccinated with hepatitis B vaccine, in my opinion, is nothing more than a marketing scheme. And I've told this story often. In 1985, I went to the CDC in Atlanta to the ACIP committee meeting. The ACIP committee is a CDC committee that issues recommendations for vaccines for the federal government. And I was there with a young mother who was reporting the death of her baby after DPT. And after we reported this death, we stayed, and there was a discussion. And remember, this is 1985. It was a discussion about the new hepatitis B vaccine that was being tested in, and it was this new recombinant DNA vaccine, hepatitis B vaccine. And I remember the manufacturer rep saying to the CDC officials, he got very annoyed, and he said, "Look, if you can't get the high-risk groups to use this vaccine, you're just going to have to go into the states and pass laws to shoot it into the arms of every high school kid in the country, because we're not going to have an orphan drug on our hands." Well, when the hepatitis B vaccine was recommended for all children in 1991, they didn't decide to shoot it into the arms of high school kids. They decided to shoot in the arms of every 12-hour-old newborn infant so that the manufacturer would not have an orphan drug on its hands.
In other words, you think that there was a large financial incentive there, and they were really more concerned about profit than they were about patient. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were talking about the hepatitis B vaccine, the fact that they're giving this to infants who are 12 hours old in the nursery, and Barbara had actually attended a meeting at the CDC 20 years ago, where a representative of the manufacturer of the hepatitis B vaccine said to the assembled doctors and members of the medical profession, "Look, you know, if you can't get the adolescents to take this, we're going to have an infant, we're going to have a, an orphan drug on our hands, an orphan vaccine. We're not going to be able to market it. I mean, you're going to have to get the people to take this vaccine," in other words. And so that's what they did. They simply said, "We've got to give it to every child, in the nursery." And yet, if you look at the benefit of this, what's the benefit to the child? Is there any benefit to the child to get a shot that early in life?
No, because one of the things is, if you look at the product manufacturer insert, that you cannot show immunity after 7 years. In other words, you're vaccinating all these little babies, newborn babies, and yet by age seven, there's no measurable immunity.
Well, now tell me,
vaccine-induced immunity.
What's going on in other countries? Because, of course, in the third world countries, literally everybody there has had hepatitis B. There are approximately 2 billion people who've gotten hepatitis B. Of course, if you look at the World Health Organization website, they will tell you that, and you read it very carefully, you realize most of them got it from the use of dirty needles given when they were giving vaccinations to help the people. But literally every child in the third world countries has had hepatitis B, and many of them become chronic carriers.
Well, but you have to, if you look in research hepatitis B disease, you realize that a lot of people, and that's true in Asia and in other countries, particularly in Asia, it's endemic. Most people have had experience with it. But the truth is that most people have hepatitis B and have antibodies. They don't go on to have chronic hepatitis B. it's only a small minority of people who go on to have chronic hepatitis B. Those people who drink, who are alcoholics, who abuse their body, go on to die eventually from hepatitis B. But hepatitis B is not like hepatitis C. And, you know, we've had, there's no vaccine for hepatitis C. But hepatitis B, a lot of people in Asia, as children, are exposed to it and have antibodies. Every time you get hepatitis B doesn't mean automatically you are going to die of liver cancer. But that's what they try to make you believe in this country.
You're absolutely right, and they're doing a good job of frightening people into taking what I believe is a totally unnecessary vaccine. But what about the complications of the hepatitis B vaccine? That's what they never talk about. They say, oh, well, this is genetically created, so it's not the real virus. So there's nothing to worry about. It's been created in the laboratory. It's a recombinant vaccine. They say that so learnedly, recombinant, and most people don't even know what the term means. So, you know, you've sort of got them off guard now.
Well, I think we everyone needs to know that there are persistent reports, even though they tried about 10 years ago, they tried to set up studies, methodologically flawed studies, that would show there was no cause and effect. There are persistent reports that hepatitis B vaccine can cause Guillain-Barré syndrome, arthritis, transverse myelitis, optic neuritis, multiple sclerosis, and other central demyelinating diseases of the nervous system. The demyelinating diseases affect the myelin sheath of the brain. It's a degeneration of the myelin sheath of the brain that helps transmit nerve impulses. And, you know, we continue to get reports of these neurological disorders after hepatitis B vaccination. And what a lot of the healthcare workers who originally got this vaccine were complaining of is the same thing that teenagers who get it complain of when they, you know, because you're going to have to give boosters of this vaccine because they give it to these little children, and then you watch, they're going to have boosters in the adolescent period. What you see is chronic disabling fatigue, crippling joint pain. I mean, terrible joint pain, vision problems, heart palpitations and problems with the heart. But most of the, you know, a lot of these children who get affected are very bright, high-functioning children, and they simply can't even go back to school.
And, of course, you get an autoimmune disease to this. The gene that they use is very similar to the molecule that you find in the myelin sheath, and so you get molecular mimicking. What happens is that the body is sensitized to this molecule, and then they recognize that everything, all the normal myelin sheath, they think is this thing they're sensitized to, begin to destroy it. There's a 300% increase in multiple sclerosis in nurses who are foolish enough to take this vaccine, the hepatitis B vaccine. 300% increase in multiple sclerosis. I'm sure you're acquainted with those figures, aren't you?
Yeah.
We'll be right back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. In fact, there was a woman, she was a scientist many years ago. I talked to her 3 or 4 years ago, named Bonnie Dunbar, Dr. Dunbar, who was she was specialty in vaccines, but she was very worried about the hepatitis B vaccine. I talked to her, and she told me that she'd really been threatened for daring to speak out against that. Whatever happened to Dr. Dunbar, do you know?
Oh, yeah, Dr. Dunbar, Bonnie Dunbar is a good friend of mine. I just heard from her a couple of months ago. She lives in Kenya now. She purchased the farm was featured in the film Out of Africa, and she turned it into Africa's best B&B. And
you're talking about a bed and breakfast over in Africa?
In Kenya, a fabulous B&B, but she is also continuing to be a scientist. She is working with the top doctors in Africa. She's doing research into HIV. She has not given up on her research on hepatitis B vaccine and her concern about the over-vaccination of children, not only in this country, but children in Africa. Because, as you know, they have repeated campaigns in Africa with these children who are malnourished, who have substandard health care, poor sanitation, etc. And they go in there again and again, the World Health Organization and these major pharmaceutical companies, and vaccinate these children repeatedly. And she's very concerned about the over-vaccination of children in Africa.
And, of course, she had actually told me she had devised a number of vaccines. Some of them were aerosol vaccines for elephants so they wouldn't get pregnant. And
right.
I mean, she really believes in vaccines, but she was so concerned about the hepatitis B vaccine. And I know that she came under tremendous pressure for daring to speak out and express her concern.
Yes, indeed. She tried to get, she's an award-winning scientist here in this country and had NIH grants, and then she suddenly couldn't get NIH grants. They turned her down. She and another researcher who appeared at our conference in 2002, trying to look into the genetic factors involved in reactions to hepatitis B vaccine. The National Vaccine Information Center, we've for, you know, several decades been urging this research into the genetic and other biological high-risk factors that put some individuals at higher risk than others for having vaccine reactions. But the government and the pharmaceutical companies refuse to do this research. Why do they refuse to do it? Well, I think they don't want to stop their one-size-fits-all approach. And that one-size-fits-all approach to vaccination is underpinned
with
the pseudo-ethic.
Hold that thought
sure.
Right there. We'll bring our other stations on right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. We're talking with Barbara Fisher about Dr. Bonnie Dunbar, who has actually left the United States and has actually set up a bed and breakfast in Kenya on a very luxurious farm, an animal farm there. And she had tried to get grants from the NIH here in this country to look at the possible complications of vaccine and over-vaccination. And the pharmaceutical companies and the NIH, the last thing they want to do is find out if there's a problem. And after all, if you don't look for the problem, why, you won't find a problem. And they've done everything they could to block the research to find out if there is a problem. This is true, with doctors who've looked into the danger of mercury in vaccines. You cannot get grants. If you can't get grants, why, of course, your academic career is finished. This is what they do. They punish the physicians and the scientists who are trying to protect the health of the American people. We got a real problem then, don't we, Doctor? No, don't we, Barbara?
Yes. Well, you know, I think, really, we all know that everyone does not respond the same way to drugs, does not respond the same way to food. I mean, there are always some who are going to have a reaction, and to think that there are not individuals who are more vulnerable than others to vaccination is just simply illogical. And I don't think it's right that you have a mandatory vaccination policy, that we are mandated to take these vaccines, and yet there's been no work done to try to identify the high-risk individuals and screen them out. What forced vaccination really amounts to, state forced vaccination, is the targeting of the genetically vulnerable for sacrifice. And I think that it's immoral and it's unconscionable that we would be asking everyone or forcing every child to have these vaccines and not find out who's at higher risk.
Well, let's talk about some of the other vaccines. What about this pneumococcal vaccine that came along? Is that a good idea or not?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I was sitting on the FDA Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, the FDA committee that actually looks at the scientific evidence that pharmaceutical companies bring to the FDA to prove that new vaccines are safe and effective. I happened to be on the committee when they were looking at the new pneumococcal vaccine, and I was pretty shocked to find out how they had conducted the manufacturer had conducted the clinical studies that were supposed to support the fact that that vaccine was safe. What they did is they ran clinical trials that compared an experimental pneumococcal vaccine against an experimental meningococcal vaccine. In other words, they did not know the reaction profile of either vaccine. They used each other as controls. Now, I know from my eighth grade science class, studying the scientific method, that would have gotten me an F if I had said that I was going to do that kind of an experiment. Everyone knows you have to compare a known against an unknown. You can't compare two unknowns against each other and figure anything out.
Well, I don't know. Merck did that with their Vioxx. They compared their Vioxx, with another product and is a COX-2 inhibitor that they knew increased the incidence of heart disease, so they figured they compared theirs with the other one, why they might come out looking pretty good. But, you know, even knowing that the other product increased the incidence of heart disease significantly, Vioxx was 3.5 times more lethal and more heart attacks than the one they were, which I believe was called Celebrex.
And that's exactly what happened in this trial also. The meningococcal vaccine the experimental one they compared it against was less reactive than the pneumococcal, but they said it didn't matter. And every time the children in the study had a seizure or ran a high fever or collapsed, the drug company wrote those problems off as being caused by the whole cell DPT vaccine that the children got at the same time as they got both experimental vaccines. And I remember saying to them, how dare you use the whole cell DPT vaccine in these trials, which were done after 1996, after the acellular vaccine, DPT, DTAP, had been licensed. I said, how dare you ethically include a whole cell DPT vaccine in these trials and write off all of these seizures and et cetera as caused by DPT and not by either one of the experimental vaccines? You have proved nothing when it comes to safety. I was the only committee member who voted no when it came to the question, has safety been demonstrated for Prevnar vaccine?
Well, let me just, for our listeners who do not understand, the original DPT vaccine, the pertussis part of the DPT, was made from the virus and some sort of a solution that came out of the virus. And there was terribly, terribly toxic. And a lot of children got convulsions and swelling of the brain, and many of them had permanent brain damage from that. Now, for 20 years, the Japanese had a much better vaccine. It was an acellular. It was, highly refined. It didn't give the reaction. So it changed over then to the acellular vaccine. So you get DPT or DAPT, diphtheria, acellular pertussis toxoid vaccine, and that at least gives you less reaction. So apparently, to be sure that they would come up with nothing but confusion with this Prevnar vaccine, they went back and they used the one that had been discarded long ago because it was so toxic. And yeah. I guess, why weren't the other people on that committee incensed that they would expose these children, these American children, to increased damage of brain, danger of brain damage?
Because they never took the DPT vaccine off the market. And so the defense of the companies was, well, it was legal. You know, the doctors had it in the refrigerators. We couldn't make them not use a licensed vaccine. You see, we lobbied for that DPT to be taken off the market once the DTAP was licensed. But the FDA and the manufacturers refused to take it off. So legally, they could still use that vaccine. But it caused great confusion in this trial because they kept writing these seizures and high fevers and collapsed shocks off as being DPT caused. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that methodologically, these studies are flawed. And every time you see a study that's coming out now from the government of Finland or Denmark or England with the drug companies financing this government studies trying to prove there's no association between autism and vaccines or mercury-containing vaccines and autism or MMR and autism, if you look at the studies carefully enough, you see they're methodologically flawed. They would not... That's why you're not seeing the truth coming out, because those in charge of supposedly looking at what is the truth are conflicted. They have conflicts of interest. Industry has too much influence over our government agencies.
But do you think anybody would intentionally hurt a child?
I think that people would intentionally try to protect their own interests. I think they would put their heads in the sand and want to believe something, because to believe something else is so awful. I mean, I talk about Wolfgang Ehrengood, a German immunologist and early DPT vaccine critic. In the 1970s, he said, the prevailing mental, the attitude among physicians when it comes to vaccine adverse events or vaccine injuries and deaths is what must not be, cannot be. I think it's psychologically and emotionally very difficult, as you pointed out earlier, for doctors who want to keep people healthy and want, people to not suffer, to believe that something that they're doing could actually harm people. And so I think they're putting their heads in the sand. And I think people at very high levels who are in these drug companies and some people in policymaking positions do know, but they have embraced the utilitarian rationale, which I started to talk about, and that is that ethically some people can be sacrificed for what they've defined as the greater good. I've always argued that that's a pseudo-ethic. I think the judges at the Nuremberg trials, or the doctor's trial after World War II at Nuremberg, also judged that utilitarianism was a pseudo-ethic, because once you walk down that road and you say that some people lives can be sacrificed for other people, how many is too many? Is 100, is 100 too many? 500, 5,000, 500,000, 5 million? How many is too many? I don't think you can ever devalue the life of an individual and say that that person can be sacrificed. That the person, if there's a sacrifice to be made, individuals have the right to have all the information and consciously make that decision to risk for the benefit of others. But I don't think the state has the right to force it on individuals without their consent.
And I certainly agree with you, and I share your concern that every life is precious and none should be sacrificed in the name of the greater good. Well, let's go on to some of the other vaccines that we, of course, have coming down the line. And you commented on this new vaccine they're coming up, for human papillomavirus. What sort of long-term studies do they have with this vaccine?
Well, this is a vaccine that has just hit the news. And I actually haven't had time to do research on it. I know that they are going to target teenagers, and I thought initially they were going to have this be an optional vaccine, but it looks as if the quotes from the researchers are that it is not going to be a voluntary vaccine, that they're going to try to make it mandatory and part of the adolescent routine vaccination schedule.
But it is only for those who are going to be promiscuous. What do they want to ensure, that everybody can be promiscuous?
Well, and that is the argument on moral grounds that some parents are taking, and some groups are saying, it's like there have been actually on hepatitis B vaccine, which is another one, sexually transmitted vaccine for a sexually transmitted disease. There have been challenges at state high court levels, like in Wyoming, by parents who say you shouldn't force my child to take a vaccine that is basically it's a lifestyle vaccine. It's for choices that are made. I bring my child up to not make those choices, to not be sexually promiscuous, to not be an IV drug user, and you're taking away my parental right to bring up my child the way I see fit by forcing my child to get hepatitis B vaccine. Actually, in Wyoming, the state high court agreed that the state does not have the right to force this kind of vaccine on a child. But vaccine laws are state laws. They're not federal. And so every state can have a different take on what the laws of that state should be regarding vaccination, even though the federal government is attempting to standardize.
Well, I think the worst thing would be to have the federal government standardized, because the federal laws certainly will never reflect what's really good for the people, but more what's good for the vaccine manufacturers.
Well,
my understanding, and now we have a wonderful new idea. We're going to take measles, mumps, rubella, and then we're going to add chickenpox to it as well. Why are we going to immunize for chickenpox? Is this a serious childhood disease? How many children die of chickenpox?
Well, before we started using the chickenpox vaccine on a routine basis, the recommendation for universal use of chickenpox vaccine began in 1995. Before 1995, we didn't have a vaccine. Most kids, as toddlers, got chickenpox. 99.999% of them had no complications. They just they had a couple of weeks of itchiness, and mom put calamine lotion on the leg, arms and legs to reduce the itchiness. But for most children, it was not a problem. They got a qualitatively superior immunity that lasted them for, you know, into adulthood. They then, in adulthood, would get boosted. The older teenagers and adults would get boosted by coming in contact with the younger children who had chickenpox, and the immunity would be extended. In other words, you would naturally be boosted. You wouldn't have symptoms or anything, but it would extend and it strengthen your immunity. What we've done now in the last 10 years of mandatory use of this chickenpox vaccine is we've taken chickenpox out of the childhood population, and what we've done in removing the ability of teenagers and adults to be boosted, those of us who had chickenpox, we've created an epidemic of shingles. And shingles is a very painful disorder that actually there's a researcher, Gary Goldman, who has published three articles in a European journal called Vaccine, and he has showed that we're going to have a much more expensive and a much more many more complications with the shingles epidemic that we have created than for the next 50 years than we would ever have had we allowed chickenpox to remain endemic in the childhood population.
And for our listeners out there, this is what they call a herpes zoster, and basically a patient will get this strip of these vesicles along the path of a nerve on the chest, and extremely painful. And it usually was seen in older people as their immune system began to fade away, and of course this was caused by the chickenpox virus. But most people got over this. Wasn't much of a problem. They get pain for a time, but most people would recover from that. And now you say we're getting a lot more of the herpes zoster or shingles infections now than we did before?
Yes, we have an epidemic of shingles now, and you are now seeing that they're developing a shingles vaccine. So you will now, I think, my prediction is you will have shingles vaccine that will eventually be mandated to counteract the shingles epidemic that was created by the chickenpox vaccine that they had everybody get. And you mentioned what was the death rate of chickenpox prior to the mass use of chickenpox vaccine in 1995? About 100 Americans would die. More than half of them were adults who had not had chickenpox as children, and in adults, chickenpox is much more serious. It's like three times the rate of complications and death than you do. So the bottom line is that chickenpox in young children is by and large not a serious disease. But if you drive it into the adult population, it can be much more serious. So that if you're going to use a vaccine, logic would say you vaccinate those who don't get it in childhood and have gotten to their teenage or adult years and not had a chickenpox, you vaccinate them, which would be a tiny minority. But see, that wouldn't be profitable for the company. That would be like having an orphan drug because not as many people would take it.
And, of course, I hate to think that there would be people within our pharmaceutical industry who would be more concerned about profit than about the patients. But, unfortunately, the reality is, of course, that's not true. We have people who really have no concern at all about the patients. It's all about the bottom line. Barbara, we're just about out of time. Would you like to get out your website and how people can get in touch with you and get more information? Because Barbara has some of the finest information that's available in the country. How can people reach you and get information?
Yes, the best way is to go on our website. It's an award-winning website. It's one of the oldest websites that's operated by healthcare consumers in our country. It's the National Vaccine Information Center, www.nvic.org. Lots of free information. You can sign up for our e-news where we get free e-news, which gives reports on vaccine developments. And you can also get in contact with us and report a vaccine reaction or anything else you'd like to contact us about.
All right, again, one more time. Is there a telephone number that they should call? How would they get in touch with you?
On the website, it gives you telephone numbers. It gives you a way to email us. You can call us at 703-938-0342.
All right, fine. One more time, the telephone number.
703-938-0342 or www.nvic.org.
Hold up, Lon. We'll be back in just 1 minute to wrap up tonight's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I guess this evening with Barbara Lowe Fisher. We've got about 3 minutes before I let you go, and I know it's getting awfully late back there where you live, and I appreciate so much your being willing to stay up with us, but I share your concern, and really more and more parents really are beginning to understand the potential danger of vaccines, aren't they?
I think that there are more parents who are asking their doctors questions. There are more parents who want to make informed selected decisions about vaccines. I think most people who contact our organization, they do want to vaccinate, but they want to vaccinate selectively. There are some who want to avoid all vaccines, but I think most people they just want the ability to make informed voluntary vaccination decisions. They don't want to be backed into a corner and threatened and pushed. They want to be respected. They want to be partners with their pediatrician in making these educated vaccination decisions. And certainly in a country, a democracy, we ought to have the right to have a say in any medical intervention that carries a risk of injury or death, and certainly vaccines like drugs and other interventions do.
Now, what about some of these children that with the shaken baby syndrome, and of course they say, they shook this baby, that's why they have all the swelling of the brain and the eye hemorrhages, but of course if you shake a baby hard enough to damage their head, you'd break their neck. I mean, most of these children are so small, you don't have to support their heads. So how many of these do you think shaken baby syndromes may actually be vaccine reactions that they're covering up?
Well, I have been involved in trying to help some families who have been charged with murder because their children had bleeding in the brain or bleeding behind the eyes. Certainly, the DPT vaccine, the whole cell vaccine, certainly had the ability to cause bleeding in the brain. We noticed that when they added the HIV vaccine, when there was a combination DPT-H, that we got an increase in the reports of bleeding in the brain following vaccination. I don't think there's any question that there's a certain number of children who have bleeding in the brain that is vaccine-induced. And the problem is that you have a lot of defensive doctors, a lot of ignorance about what vaccines can do because they refuse to do the studies and look at and get down to the cellular molecular level, which we have the tools to do now, and find out exactly what's happening in the body.
We're out of time. God bless you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much
for being with us, and thank you for everything you're doing and really in defense of children and trying to get parents to understand that if they really love their children, they're going to want to research this subject and know it backwards and forward and be able to discuss it intelligently because if so many parents have found out to the dismay that once their child is permanently damaged, permanent is for a long, long time. Good night. God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I asked a question during the program. I said, is there anybody who would really want to hurt children? Well, let me answer that question. Yes, there are people who want to hurt children. There are people who want to kill children. We have killed over 40 million children here in the United States through abortion. And we have financed the killing of probably 10 times that many throughout the rest of the world with our funding of the various international Planned Parenthood and family planning organizations. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, as difficult as it may seem, there really are people who would hurt children. We saw this practice in the concentration camps in Nazi Germany when you had evil people in positions of power and experimenting on children. And they're doing exactly the same thing in America. They're experimenting on our children. It's about time you got the research and the understanding, and we do hope that many of you go to Barbara Lowe Fisher's website. We hope that you go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. We have a little booklet called Genetic Engineering and Population Control. We go into the whole background of the vaccines, their production, and of course the disastrous results of many of these vaccines. Yes, it's been wonderful to do away with polio. But did you realize that, of course, that the original polio vaccine contained a cancer virus? And we contaminated literally the majority of the American population with simian virus 40, which is a cancer-producing monkey virus. And this is one reason, in my estimation, why the incidence of cancer is rising so rapidly in America. But they can't let the American people know that. please go to our website at www.radioliberty.com and look up the virus and the vaccine. Well, we have 4 tape sets on vaccines. We have so much information that is available. And, of course, if you are interested, you'd like a free newsletter on vaccines, we'd be glad to send you one free of charge. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope you'll go to our website. You can listen to our radio programs there 5 hours a day, directly or indirectly, on the various networks we're on. We're 5 hours a day on the Internet, 5 hours a day on radio somewhere in America. We're on shortwave and satellite 4 hours a day. We do hope that many of you out there in the listening audience will make a decision to help Radio Liberty, to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and help us as we reach out across America, indeed across the whole world, trying to educate the people that we are involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, cultural, and ideological battlefield. And there really are evil and wicked people in the world who have a different world agenda because they march to a different drumbeat. They dream a different dream. They worship a different God. There really are evil people in the world who are in contact with the other dimension. And so we, of course, want to remind you we're having an all-day seminar here in the Monterey Bay area where I live in California on the 19th of November. And if you can make it, we'd love to hear from you. But you have to call and make a reservation, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station we're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please do not put in a call unless we specifically ask for it. We have with us this hour Cal Grunwald, who supports Radio Liberty, and he certainly, we've had a friend, we've had him on many times, and we were going to talk again about what's happening to the economy of our country. You know, it's really very interesting. Most people don't understand that we have a fiat money system in America. In other words, we have a paper money system with absolutely no value behind it other than the faith in our government and the faith in the ability of our Federal Reserve System, which is a privately owned central bank. Let me repeat that. Our Federal Reserve System is a privately owned central bank. The ability of these people to manipulate our economy and keep the value of our currency from being destroyed. Now, certainly down through the ages, every fiat money currency system has been destroyed. It happened in ancient Greece. It had happened many times before that. Aristotle, and you'll find this quotation in Bartlett's famous quotations, Aristotle said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with fiat money as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in kings. And I think Aristotle was absolutely right. Every other system has fallen because we did not have perfect authority. We did not have godlike wisdom in kings. We had people managing the money system who looked more after themselves than after the good of the country. And eventually the system collapsed and the people were impoverished, as is happening in Rhodesia today, where they have 400% inflation, as happened in Argentina just 3 years ago, where the life savings of the people were completely wiped out. Unfortunately, here in America today, we are in uncharted waters, at least according to Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve System. A few years ago, why they were very, very concerned about the danger of deflation, in other words, falling prices. So to try to stimulate the economy, they poured massive amounts of money into our system, and then they began to lower interest rates, and they lowered interest rates, and lowered interest rates, and lowered interest rates to stimulate the economy, to keep it from collapsing. And they got their interest rates down to 1%, and they were able to produce a great building program, and they were able to produce a great deal of construction and investment on the part of industry, and of course this worked. But of course then you begin to get inflation. So now, to stave off inflation, they're beginning to raise the interest rates, but they're still pouring massive amounts of money into the system, creating money out of nothing. And every time they do that, of course, they destroy the value of the people who've worked their whole lives to amass money, not understanding we have a fiat money system. Why? Of course, many people, if they have their money in CDs or in bank deposits or certainly in savings accounts, things of that sort, or pension funds, these will all be wiped out if we have a severe monetary contraction. Our guest this evening, Cal Grunwald. Cal, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, that's Stan. It's always good to be on your show.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you've been watching this for a long time, haven't you?
Oh, yes. It's kind of frightening what's happening now lately.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. We're going to let Cal tell you about his thoughts as far as what's unfolding now. Because as Alan Greenspan says, we're in uncharted waters. And, of course, we're going to see an awful lot of these artificial assets that have been created with nothing behind them begin, of course, to contract and contract drastically. Well, Cal, what's your take on what's going on right today in America?
Well, again, you prefaced it very well when you said that, you know, how the Fed is trying to control inflation now. They pumped in massive amounts of money, which they're still doing after Katrina and Rita. And all this is doing is contributing to the inflation, and now the government has come out with new inflation numbers. Even they're alarmed at them when they're actually 3-4 times greater than that, because they don't include food, fuel, or housing. So they're raising rates to cut, you know, to try to stem the tide of inflation, but they're not doing a very good job of that either. So they're kind of chasing their tail now, and of course the public is in the middle of it, not really knowing what's going on because they never told the truth. It's a rather concerning situation right now. Our dollar is continuing to fall against the euro and foreign currencies. The rest of the world is continuing to reject the dollar. The Muslim world is united now to bring the West down, bring America down because of what George Bush has done over there. And some very disconcerting things are happening just because of that. As I mentioned on the last show, again to reiterate, the Muslim world is making a concerted effort to hurt us, and how better than to affect our currency. And about 6 weeks ago, Saudi Arabia converted $368 billion American dollars into euros and yen. And that day, the dollar dropped 6 points against the euro. The euro rose six points that day. A week later, then Saudi Arabia turned around and gave our oil contract to China. And that's what hit Mobil Exxon very hard, because most of their oil comes from Saudi Arabia. It's a pretty frightening situation because we're earmarked. George Bush is the number one wanted terrorist around the world, and of course we don't hear these things in our media. They would never dream of saying anything like that, which of course is the truth. But it's a very bad situation out there, and of course a lot of things are happening with gold and silver too, which we'll kind of cover a little bit later on. But
well, I think really what's happening with the gold and silver markets is you're not hearing about that from the controlled media. In fact, it used to be MSNBC would post what was happening, that gold, every couple of minutes up there on the screen. Since gold has started to move up, they simply have totally ignored it. Why? Because they don't want the American people to know that gold has made one of the most dramatic moves here in this last month or so, that it's made probably in the last decade. Would you agree with that pretty well?
Well, absolutely. A month ago, I was just going to say that, so you're right on. A month ago, gold was around 430. And
hold that thought right there. We'll be right back with Kyle Grunbaugh. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're simply, Cal has been pointing out, that the whole economic system is really more or less in shambles, that the Fed has been telling us that we've only had 2% inflation. They've been lying. The inflation rate is probably up close to 10%. All you have to do is look and see what's happened to the price of energy. Look and see what's happened to the price of rents. Look and see what's happened to the price of housing. Look and see what's happened to the price of certainly of your utilities, your natural gas, your electricity. Look and see what's happening to the price of food, and then tell me we have a 2-3% inflation. You can tell when a government official is lying because his lips are moving, or he has written something down and you read it, but they're not being objective with us. The last thing they want is for the American people to really learn the truth. Now, Cal was making the point that there's been a dramatic increase in the price of gold. It's not being talked about in the controlled media, but how long ago was it that gold was at 430?
About a month ago.
And where is it now?
Today it finished at 477.50. So that's a $47 increase in a month's time. That is the most dramatic increase in the last decade. I totally agree.
And that's almost a 10% increase in the past month. And yet, of course, this is being totally suppressed by the controlled media. You know, when things are really happening in a specific market, they'll ordinarily announce that on the evening business news and probably the evening television news, unless, of course, they don't want you to know what's happening. And it is very, very apparent, watching the evening business news, they never tell you what's happening to gold and silver. When, of course, they start reporting it, you know we're almost at the top. That's the time to get out, not when it's taking a run-up, because they don't want you to know it's beginning to run. Now, what's happening to silver as well? Because gold and silver usually move together.
Yes, silver finished today at $7.88, almost at 8. And again, a month ago, it was around 7.20, 7.25, so it's risen as dramatically as gold has.
Almost a 10% increase then as well.
Yes.
So these are really, of course, dramatic figures that you're not going to hear about through ordinary channels. Now, you know, what is really happening now is the Federal Reserve System is trying to cut down inflation, so they're progressively raising interest rates, which is going, of course, to end the housing bubble. is going to end all the construction and people borrowing money at low rates so they can, of course, do the massive building and construction and expansion of industry. Industry is really doing pretty well. I mean, a lot of them are making a lot more money, but they're not making it here in the United States. They're making their money by moving their factories overseas. And I think one of the most dramatic and almost frightening things I've seen is something called Delphi, D-E-L-P-H-I, actually manufactures automotive parts of dashboards, various things for the cars. They have been a subsidiary of General Motors. Apparently, they've taken them back. But workers at Delphi have been getting $26 to $30 an hour. And the company now is saying, you take $10 to $12 an hour, about a third of what you were getting, or we're going to move over to China. And I fear that the workers, desperate for jobs, are going to take it. You're talking about almost a two-thirds decrease in salary, you know, for these poor, unfortunate people. Many of them have been working there for many years, living it up. I mean, $26 to $30 an hour, that was real money. How are they going to get by on $10 to $12 an hour? But that's what Delphi is offering them. And I think this is a beautiful example of what is planned. An organized effort to lowering the living standards of the American people. But, of course, they can't tell the American people that is part of the official policy of the people who control our monetary system. What do you think about that, Cal? Did you see that article about offering these people who have been working for Delphi for such a long period of time, about a third of the previous salaries?
Well, I didn't see the article, but it doesn't surprise me. In fact, of course, being a, you know, in the automotive parts industry or business, it's going to really affect companies like General Motors. And now they're saying that General Motors before had a 10% chance of going into bankruptcy, but now because of this, they've got a 30% chance of going into bankruptcy.
Well, of course, what the bankruptcy for General Motors will mean was that all those people who've worked for them for such a long period of time will end up losing their pensions. I talked to a gentleman today who worked for General Motors, he worked for them for 35 years. And he's frightened about losing his job, and I can't say I blame him, but of course, after 35 years, he would have a pretty good pension, but he can't get his pension, he can't get his money until he retires, and of course, by the time he retires, why, if General Motors goes into bankruptcy, and of course, and they know how to do that, they can preserve some of their wealth by doing that, or moving their factories over to China, what will happen? They'll turn over their pension obligation to the Pension Guarantee Benefit Corporation, a U.S. corporation, and you and I will be paying their pension, but not, you know, 90 cents on the dollar, maybe 30, 35 cents on the dollar. And these people have worked all their lives expecting to get a pension are going to find out they're impoverished. I think that's terrible criminal activity. It certainly is immoral, isn't it?
Well, yes, and of course, that's where our whole system is set up like that. You know, they promise you everything in the future when you retire, but look what's happening to the pension funds. They're drying up. They're shriveling up. They're going away. They're disappearing. And so people are going to be facing nothingness when it comes to retirement. That's why it's one of the reasons I'm suggesting to people very strongly now that before, you know, while they still have something, to convert some of that into gold and silver, while you can still get some gold and silver, some real money. Because when our currency collapses, you know, it won't make any difference how much is in your pension fund or your retirement plan, it will be a big nothing anyway when the dollar collapses. So people are just, in of course, comatose state here, just thinking that everything is going to somehow miraculously turn around at the end and come out all right, but it's not going to come out all right.
Well, of course, the thing is that there is no way that they can possibly pull this thing off. If they continue raising the interest rates, they will stifle our economy. And, of course, then we will begin moving into depression. If they don't do that, we will go into inflation and destroy the value of our currency, and the whole house of cards will come toppling down, as it did in ancient Greece, as it did in Rome, certainly under Diocletian in the 3rd century A.D., when, of course, Diocletian massively expanded the money supply, created runaway inflation, then imposed wages trades and price controls. Exactly as President Nixon did, you know, in 1970, imposed wage and price controls to try to control the inflation that his policies had created, of course. And, of course, then went from bad to worse. And, of course, by late 1979, we were running a 16 to 18% inflation here, with interest rates well up over 20%. And all these people who thought that they could play the system and invest and do all this borrowing and building suddenly found themselves losing everything they had. I know that happened to a number of my doctor friends at that time who thought that they knew how to play the system, and they did, but they didn't understand the cycles. And they came into the wrong part of the cycle, as so many people have done, only to find out, of course, it led not to prosperity but to poverty. So, you know, as we see what's really going on now, of course, we see the price of oil is up over 40% what it was a year ago. And, of course, the price is down around $60, $62 a barrel. Everybody says, oh, that's so much better than it was at $70 a barrel, without realizing, of course, that we're still up over 40% where we were. What impact is the rising price of oil and the other petroleum products going to have, Cal?
Well, again, it's more of a burden on the American person, probably because their wages aren't increasing to cover that. There is no complementary rising in wages to account for inflation. So people just have to cut down, they have to trim down, and they have to live more conservatively and frugally if they intend to survive and to make it. Now they're talking about, you know, home heating oil prices in the wintertime, you know, rising another 70%, 50 to 70%. Well, what are people going to do with that? You know, they're getting hit everywhere at all at one time, and they say there's no inflation. Well, something's got to give, and it's not a good omen. It really isn't.
Well, of course, they're pointing out that many of the stores that sell things like Target and certainly the other major stores that are selling a lot of products, I mean, they're actually their income has been fairly good this last quarter, but of course that doesn't take into account the fact that, you know, as we move into the winter and the price of natural gas is going to go up 40 to 70% across America, and the price of electricity, of course, is going to go up. The price of heating oil is going to go up, and if the price of gasoline stays up where it is, and certainly the price of delivery, the price of air transportation is going to have to go up to cover the increased cost of jet fuel. Federal Express is going to be raising their rates another 5%. People are going to have a lot less money to spend at Target stores and at May's department store and at all the other stores that we have out there that are selling so many things, the Home Depot and Costco. And if they're not, of course, selling as much, why, this is going to begin to slow down the economy, too. I mean, I think that we're faced with two things. We either have deflation, and as people have less and less money to spend, or they will do what governments usually do when faced with a choice between deflation and inflation, and they'll go ahead and inflate the economy, even if it means they have to totally destroy the value of our currency by so doing. Because politicians, and certainly the heads of central banks, very seldom act responsibly. To Paul Volcker's credit, back in 1979 and 1980, he did what was necessary to prevent the total collapse of our economic system, which we faced at that time. And we built a solid base and began one of the greatest economic increases and cycles of prosperity in the history of the world. But as with all cycles of prosperity, they do come to an end. We'll be back in just a moment with Cal Grunwald. And, of course, if you're out there in the listening audience, would like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Cal Grunwald. Cal, you know, as you look and see what's happening at the present time, do you think we're going to go into a deflation, or you think we're going to go into inflation, or will we have a combination of the two?
Well, I see more inflation rising its ugly head. Increased prices. Of course, the government's been pumping in billions and billions and billions of dollars, free money, into the economy as the hurricane relief, and this has to come back to hurt everybody. a temporary relief, but the end result is not good. So I see inflation coming, raging like a lion, and of course the government's lying about the numbers. And that's going to affect everything, and you know, $1,500 goes nowhere these days. You can put $50 in your tank without even thinking about it.
I filled up my Suburban tank the other day. I thought I might as well have a full tank of gas, and came to $94. I mean, I've never seen anything like that before. I knew it was going to be high, but I'll have to admit I was shocked. We don't use our Suburban very much, but, you know, we just have it for short trips and that sort. Well, I'll tell you, we're not going to be taking very many trips when it takes $94 to fill up the gas tank, that's for sure. And I think that's going to impact on a lot of people. What do you hear from talking to people? And I know you do spend a lot of time talking to people about the economy. Are most of them concerned about what's going on, or are most of them think that, of course, nothing good bad could ever happen to America?
As I talk to people, and I am more and more all the time, especially when gold has been going up the way it is, people are very alarmed at what's happening, and they're so confused they really don't know what to do. They don't know really where to turn. I've been talking to people a lot about, you know, preserving some of their wealth with gold and silver, and you know, that's why I offer this free paper entitled Gold and How to Avoid the Scams in the Coin Industry. I would like to say a few things about some of the new things I've heard out there that are kind of alarming to me, and some of them have to do with logic, and others have to do with plain scams. One of the biggest things that I've run into is there are companies out there, as I mentioned before, that recommend these high mint state coins, the MS64, 65, 66s, 63s, you know, the so-called investment coins. These are usually $20 Liberties or $20 St. Gaudens, and they get professionally graded by PCGS or NGC, the two grading firms. But these companies that sell them are interested only in their own profits, and they sell them for anywhere from 4 to 6 to 7 times what you need to pay for a $20 gold piece if you want those. Now, I talked to a couple on the phone who probably put in $45,000 to $50,000 into these high mint state coins, you know, bought from one of the biggest coin companies in the country. I won't mention their name, but I call them the biggest scam company in the country, and I'll tell anybody on the phone if you want to talk to me privately who they are. But they're considering, you know, after they heard me on the radio, of repositioning those coins into, you know, silver, you know, 90% silver and some, you know, maybe low-grade $10 or $20 liberties and some bullion. So we were talking about doing that, and whenever I can advantage somebody and so they end up with more ounces of gold and silver than they started, then it's usually a good thing for people that may be a paper loss, but they're gaining more ounces, which is ultimately the goal. But later on, when gold and silver, when the currency collapses, gold and silver will be, you know, worth an awful lot per ounce, and they'll be worth, their gold and silver will be worth that much more. So they called this company, and this company said that, oh, they better not.
Hold that stuff right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Cal Grunewald, and he's basically talking about what really happens sometimes in the gold and silver business. And there are a lot of people out in this business, and I will tell you that some of the people are real charlatans, and they will try to sell you, as Cal points out, these very specialized gold coins, MS63, 64, 65, that's grading. The level they're actually graded by professionals, but of course the cost of these coins is way out of proportion to what they should be in relationship to the gold. And Cal was just saying that, you know, that a lot of the people are really being taken advantage of, and he has some papers he'd be glad to send out to people free of charge on how to avoid these scams in the gold market. So he was just saying that this one couple had been in touch with him, and they'd invested a lot of money in these overpriced gold coins, the so-called collector's gold coins. They sort of, you know, give you the idea, well, if they're collector's gold coins, then they're not going to confiscate them when the government collects all the gold from everybody, but there's no guarantee of anything at all. It is what they do is playing on people's fears to sell them overpriced merchandise. Anyway, Cal, what happened when these people called the company that bought these products from?
When they talked to the company, the broker said, well, you know, you can't you know, you can sell these back, but you better not do that because, you know, in the FEMA document, 350-page document that you can go look in the library, in FEMA, they cover gold confiscation. In the FEMA document, it says that they will confiscate any gold coin that is not MS-61 or above.
Where is that really true? Is that just all?
Well, that's what I'm saying is that when I heard that, I was just shocked, and I got immediately angry because I knew the thing was a big lie. So I called my suppliers. I've got four of them, and I posed this to each of these gentlemen, and they've been in the business all their life, all of them, and they all just laughed. And they said, "What a joke! It's a pure lie. The thing doesn't exist." So what they did is they told this older couple, naive couple, nice people, to go down to the library and look in this FEMA document, you know, for this section on gold confiscation, and it's a pure hoax. And this is what just infuriated me, because, you know, now these people are so confused, they don't know what to do, you know, because they were told by this supposedly reputable company that, you know, the government is, FEMA is not going to confiscate anything MS-61 and above. It's just, it's a hoax, it's a lie. And it just really made me mad. So I want to tell everybody that, you know, watch out for companies like this, because the reason that they recommend these coins to you is because there's huge profits in it for them. You get stuck with this real rare coin that you paid six or seven times what you had to, and in the end, when you have to crack it out of the plastic case, it costs 75 cents. It's going to be worth whatever gold is that day, and you're never going to get your money out of it. So that's, it just really upset me.
Well, of course, now
they're taking advantage of these innocent people.
Well, I think this is one of the things that really bothers me, and why we've run into this, of course, with some people, that they basically tell the people, oh, you know, these are such great coins because, you know, these are collector's items, and these are not going to be confiscated, you know, when the government starts collecting gold. But, you know, these, many of the coins that they're putting out are not collector's items at all.
Well, that's right, and there's another thing, too, that I've been running into a lot. There are those out there who advocate silver as a much, much better investment than gold. Now, granted, if, say, for instance, silver is $7 an ounce, and if it gets to $50 an ounce as it did in 1980, you know, that's a seven times multiplier. So they're talking about silver when the currency collapses, you know, to get to anywhere from $50 to $75 to $100 an ounce, which it no doubt will. Now, what I'm concerned about is being practical when I talk to people. And in my paper, I explain in a very logical way, and again, I don't have, you know, a perfect corner on wisdom here, obviously, but it does make sense to most people when I tell them that what you want to prepare yourself for down the road is when our currency collapses, you want to have two things. You want to have something you can barter with, something that's practical, something that everybody will recognize and accept in a barter situation, and something that works. And then you want something of, you know, contract store value that you can preserve your wealth with.
We're going to have to go to break. Why don't you put out your telephone number there, Cal, and how people can reach you if they'd like to?
It's 414-234-8267.
Yeah, one more time.
414-234-8267.
All right, fine. I'll hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. And, of course, we'll invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Cal Grunwald, and we're just talking about what's really going on in our economy. And if you look and see what's happening, why, certainly more and more of our factories are moving overseas. More and more of our jobs are moving overseas. the government steadfastly refuses to defend our borders because there is a plan, and of course it's a plan of the Council on Foreign Relations. They've actually published it. Phyllis Schlafly has written about it extensively from the Council on Foreign Relations' own policy papers, talking about how we don't want to defend our borders here between us and Mexico. We want to defend our borders in southern Mexico. We want to, of course, unite Mexico, the United States, and Canada. And then, of course, we defend Mexico's southern border. We are going to have one big happy country. That is why they have never insisted that we have English as the official language of the United States. Why? Because they don't want an American country. They want a bilingual country. They want a bicultural country. They want to destroy the culture of this country because the leaders of both political parties have no loyalty to the United States. Their loyalty is to globalism. This idea of creating a one-world government, and of course, uniting the Western Hemisphere, at least the northern part of it, is the first step towards uniting the world. And just as they've united Europe, they're beginning to unite, and they will be uniting Asia under the leadership of China, so they're going to unite the Western Hemisphere. And then, of course, their hope is to unite the whole of the Western Hemisphere, and then to take the three major blocks, or maybe four major blocks in the world, and bring them all under this centralized control. Everything is in place. We have a world executive, that's the Secretary General of the United Nations. We have a world legislature, that's the General Assembly. We have a world court and a world criminal court. We have a world police force, it's called Interpol. We have a world intelligence organization, it's called Echelon, where, of course, they're reading every one of your faxes and emails. And if you don't know anything about the National Security Agency and Echelon, you better learn about it. Radio Liberty carries a great deal of information. In fact, a wonderful book called Big Brother and Little Brother by and it really goes into the background of the intelligence organizations and how they're monitoring people right here in the United States in violation of all of our laws. But you see, the people who are in control don't believe in law. They have their own agenda because these people, of course, march to a different drumbeat. They dream a different dream. They worship a different God. Well, our guest this evening is Carl Grunwald. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Everybody's sort of talking about the things that are happening here, and as we were pointing out, the price of oil, even though now it's down to about $61.50 a barrel, the price of oil is still up over 41% from where it was at the same time last year. We're increasingly finding that the prices of things generally are going up. It's anticipated that the corporate profits are going to be up 14-15%, at least in this quarter. Whether they'll be able to hold or not, it doesn't really matter. At least that's where they are right now, 14-15% for the major corporations that have. But these are the corporations that have moved the base of operation overseas. The corporations which stay here in this country, like General Motors and Ford, are simply facing economic collapse. General Motors and Ford both lose money on every car they produce. Toyota and the others can make money. How can they make money? Because they don't have the massive pension obligations to fund or the health care costs to fund because they've located their factories here in the United States. And, of course, they have a very young workforce compared with the aging workforce and the retired workforce of GM and Ford. And the only way that Ford and General Motors can survive is simply to cut off the income of the people who worked for them for so long. So this is really, when you have a competitive world, you have no tariffs. And then, of course, next year or the year after that, why the Chinese are going to begin to flooding their cars into our market. And they'll be good cars, and they'll work very well. And they'll be much, much less than the cars that are produced domestically here. And I fear this will have an impact, certainly not only on American automotive manufacturing, but even on Toyota and Nissan and Honda, which have factories here in the United States. and Hyundai, too, is open factories here. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. I do know that many of the people who are working in the automotive industry are very, very concerned for their future. I talked to a surgeon, an orthopedic surgeon, yesterday morning, and, of course, he's been around for a long time. I think he practices in Illinois. He told me that today he's making a third of what he did in 1990. He's making a third of what he did. Well, first of all, of course, they put tremendous clamps and restrictions on what professional people can make, but if you're out there in the labor force and you think you're going to be able to survive, you know, the good times will continue, and all you have to do is organize and, you know, go on strike, I think you're in for a big, big surprise, especially government employees who have it so good because all they have to do, you know, is, you know, put their money in to elect the legislators. But the trouble is, the legislators have the restrictions, and if there isn't enough money, if the money isn't coming into taxation, how are they going to be able to fund, you know, all the things that they're doing and all the employees? Well, I think you see what's happened in New Orleans. In New Orleans, of course, because of the catastrophe there, they've simply laid off 3,000 city employees. And I think there are an awful lot of government employees here in this country who are going to find they're going to be in the same situation before very long. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Call, you pick up and let our listeners know what your thoughts are about what we've been talking about.
Well, again, you're, as usual, right on of what you see happening around there. I wanted to continue the thought that I had before. I was explaining that what I'm hearing a lot from people is apparently there are people advocating silver for investment purposes. And it's simply because it will multiply at a much higher rate than gold will. And I had one person tell me the other day, just yesterday, that he doesn't intend to buy any gold because silver is a much better investment. So I spent a long time trying to convince him or talk to him, try to persuade him that he has to be practical. And, you know, and I always pose the scenario, you know, imagine the day when the dollar collapses, what is it going to be like? And how will people function, and how will they buy things, and how will they barter, and with what will they barter? And so I was explaining to him, I said, either you have to have a commodity that everybody else wants and needs on a day-to-day basis, or you have to have some money that everybody recognizes as money. So that's why in my recommendation to people, I recommend a bag of what's called 90% of junk silver for household. Now that's the dimes, quarters, and half dollars that were minted prior to 1965. And that's 55 pounds of coin. So that'll take you, you know, a long time, a year or two to get through, at least. It'd even take you 3 years to get through all that on a day-to-day basis. Now, there are dealers out there that say just because silver's going to do much better as an investment, it's going to make you more money. That's what they say. It's going to make you more money than gold proportionally. They're selling people bag after bag after bag of silver, and people are piling up 7, 10, 15, 20 bags of silver, and where are you going to store it? How are you going to transport it? I mean, how are you going to use it? And when the dollar's collapsed, what are you going to turn it into? So what does it mean you're going to make more money? You have to have some money, some paper money to turn it into if you're going to do it for investment purposes. So it's all backward logic. So What I try to explain to people in a practical way, as I do in my paper, is that, you know, silver has to be utilitarian. It has to be useful for something, and you've got to have silver in moderation because it's not for investment purposes or to make money. It's for barter. It's for practical situations. So if you, people want a bag of silver, maybe two. If you get two bags of silver, that's 110 pounds of silver. What are you going to do if you have to pick up and take off? You're going to have a lot of weight, out of volume, and where are you going to carry it? Where are you going to put it? On the other hand, gold, you know, I advocate of your precious metals, 90% should be in the gold because that's the contract store value, and 10% in the silver for barter. So these companies that advocate either bags of silver, you know, multiple bags of silver, or 100 ounce bars of silver, They because they're a good price, they advocate people buying just bar after bar after bar. I talked to a man yesterday to spend $300,000 on 100-ounce silver bars. I was flabbergasted. I said, where did you put them? He said, under my bed. I said, well, your bed must be 10 feet off the ground then. Of course, he laughed, and it was kind of funny, but, you know, I tried to reason with him about the practicality of having, you know, 700 or 800 pounds of silver bars. What are you going to do if you have to leave quickly? Well, that's never going to happen. You know, so he dismissed every one of my, what I consider a very logical argument, you know, by saying, you know, that silver is a better investment.
Well, I mean, really, if you had some means of storing it safely, the upside potential on silver really is really quite good, isn't it?
Well, exactly. That's the point. If you had a means to sell it, and if we were living in a stable economy where you could say, well, I watch the price of silver, and if it goes up, you know, 50 cents or a dollar, I can sell a bunch of it and make a dollar. If people were speculators, then that would be fine. But we're living on the edge of chaos right now. Economic chaos around the world, you know, terrorist attack any time. Anything can happen. You know what happened in Argentina. They closed the bank doors. Well, if you have all that, you know, you have all that silver in your possession, that's one thing. But what are you going to do with it in a situation, look what happened in World War II. You know, the European Jews, a lot of them had the foresight to throw a gold coin in their overcoats or something, and that bought them passage to freedom, either in England or the United States.
Well, don't you think that people should be diversified into as many things as they possibly can that will give them, you know, give them some protection? In other words, if you're all in one thing, why, of course, you are susceptible to whatever might happen. Aren't you better to be in lots of things that would preserve value?
Well, that's exactly the point. And what I encourage people to do is, now's the time not to be speculating on anything. You better preserve what you have. Look at what you have, where it is, and say, is it in my control? Is it tangible? Do I have, am I in command of it? So if you've got, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 in the stock market, you know, is it really yours? Well, it is on paper. It's an electronic number on a computer chip someplace, but you don't have control of it. And so people are intimidated, of course, by the tax consequences of taking their 401ks out or their IRAs early or whatever it is. And the government is very good at that. If you take it out, you're going to lose half of it. Well, better to have 50% of nothing than 0% of nothing. So yes, diversify. You'll get your food, you know, for year to a worth of food, and your gold and silver, other tangibles like medical supplies. I mean, there's so many things that people can, you know, be prepared without panicking. You don't have to say the world's going to end tomorrow. But people have to look at the potential of a disaster happening, and then what's going to happen to your paper or electronic money if that happens. Now, what has happened now in the last month has been so dramatic in gold, and see, there's a lot of factors contributing to gold going up, and one of the biggest ones is that worldwide production is the lowest it's been since 1931, and demand is the most severe it's ever been right now. It's even greater than it was before Y2K. And now, well, you know, two of my biggest suppliers are almost totally out of gold coins. They still have some silver because, you know, they say there's a shortage of silver, and that's really not true, although that's kind of getting trimmed down. But the demand for gold coins, they're just basically gone. You know, it might loosen up. That's what I've been telling people for months. You've heard me. We're getting into an availability problem. Well, now we've got a serious one.
Well, of course, my understanding is that they're certainly over in India. They're buying an awful lot of gold. In fact, this is one of the things in India is they certainly seem to value precious metals much more than the people here in the United States, because in India they don't trust paper money. And the same thing really is happening in China, the purchases of precious metals. And in Japan, the purchase of metals is going up. And I think this is one reason why the central banks have been almost forced to sell large amounts of gold to try to keep the price down, because the last thing the central banks want is for the people to have something of intrinsic value as a means of storage of wealth. As Alan Greenspan wrote so well back in 1965 in an essay he wrote, talking about how the secret of the welfare state was this, that they don't want you to have any means to protect your wealth. In fact, that's why they made gold illegal, so you would have no means to protect yourself. And, you know, if there was a means to protect yourself, they'd have to make that illegal too. But they cannot let the people know that the central banks, the people who really control the wealth of the world, don't want you anything to be able to protect your wealth, but they certainly want to protect theirs. We notice what Warren Buffett is doing. He's investing overseas tremendous sums of money. He's put, I don't know how many, hundreds of millions of dollars into silver, and he's shorting the American dollar. He lost actually $300 million gambling that the dollar was going to fall last year, and it didn't go down significantly. In fact, it came back up again. And what did he do after that tremendous loss? He maintained his position. It's going to be interesting to see what happens at the end of this year and the end of next year, if he will still hold his position gambling that the American dollar is going to collapse, or at least going to fall, and fall dramatically. And as he said in a letter to his shareholders at Berkshire Hathaway, he would hate to see this happen. It would have such a profound impact on everything else that they possess, but or that they hold. But he believes that this is really what's going to happen, and he's trying to protect himself and, of course, the holders of his stock. So I think that when you see people like Warren Buffett doing things like that, we know that George Soros and Bill Gates have invested in precious metals and invested overseas. Why, things really don't look that stable right here, do they?
No, they don't. When these people are making those drastic moves, we can definitely learn from them and in our own small way, you know, do something similar to preserve our wealth. I'm encouraging people to, you know, get out of electronic money as much as possible, you know, have your cash cushion, you know, get prepared and, you know, kind of wait on the sidelines with your wealth in your hand and your tangibles in your hand and your food in your hand, so to speak. Wait and see what happens because, you know, we're not in for anything good here. And again, it's not doom and gloom, it's just reality.
What sort of gold coins should people buy?
Well, again, I recommend a combination of, you know, the bullion coins like the American Eagles, you know, the $10 and $20 Liberties, in the low grade, you know, where the premium is real close to spot, and then of course the 90% silver. So your initial cost or investment is very close to what will be the price of gold and silver is. That way, when gold and silver go up, you're quickly you know, up about 10 or 15%. I tell people you're pretty much you're breaking even. And then, you know, from then on, your investment grows. I tell people if you spend $6,500 on a bag of silver now, when silver gets to $50 a pound, that same bag is going to be worth over $40,000 in actual purchasing power.
Well, now, what does a bag of silver cost these days?
About $6,200, $6,300, somewhere in there. It varies. It's gone up quite a bit. Again, it's amazing that even though there's a real severe shortage of gold, the coins haven't increased that much in price as they did before Y2K. Before Y2K, for some reason, the price of these coins, you know, was tremendously higher than it is now. Even though now there's really a dramatic shortage of these coins, the silver was, you know, more reasonable, far more reasonable back then too. So It's a serious problem right now, and you know, people are taking a look at doing something that should do it fairly soon, because once gold gets to $500 an ounce, which my major supplier predicted at the beginning of the year, by the end of the year, gold would be $500 an ounce, and it probably will surpass that if it keeps going the way it is.
What about things like Kruger Rands and Austrian 100 Coronas, things like that?
Well, again, the Kruger Rands, I don't mind. I sell those sometimes. When I sell bullion, I usually sell 1/10 ounce simply because they're the most practical. And, you know, I always think about a situation where a person could use these coins in a barter situation. That's why I don't like 1 ounce, you know, American Eagles or Maple Leafs or Kruger Rands, because they're just going to be too bulky and, excuse me, too hard to use in a barter situation. So if I do sell bullion coins, they're like a 1/10 ounce or 1/4 ounce. I'm always thinking about practicality and how people can use them. You know, not, you know, these are the cheapest coins and they're going to increase in price the most, you're going to make the most money. I never talk about making money on gold and silver because it's exactly the wrong reason to buy them. People who buy these coins are not speculators. They're looking to preserve wealth. So it's not about making money at all.
I mean, it's about, you know, more or less about preserving money.
Preserving money and having something to barter with. So that's That is my approach, and it is very logical. And you know, once you talk to people, and they say, "Well, I guess that does make sense."
Why don't you get your money?
Because what are you going to convert it into? The dollar collapses.
Why don't you get your telephone number out just one more time, and you will send them the material on the various scams in the business.
Yes, I've written a 26-page paper entitled "Bold and How to Avoid the Scams in the Coin Industry," and it's a pretty educational piece. My number is 414-234-8267.
One more time.
414-234-8267. And I do want to tell people about my new company, too, so if we get some time.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening has been Cal Grunwald. We've certainly been talking about what's happening economically. And although certainly most people would like to sort of ignore this, I think it's vitally important. I think we have to be prepared for all sorts of things. There's been a great deal of emphasis recently on the danger of the avian flu epidemic. And I will tell you one thing, that they've invested an awful lot of time and effort to scare us to death about the danger of avian flu. They also have the ability to create the genetic changes they keep saying they're so concerned about. In fact, they have actually, in one of the laboratories in Wisconsin, they have actually been experimenting and have made a new type of flu that's far more deadly than anything ever before. Why would you do something like that? Certainly we know the anthrax got out of the scientific laboratories, the weaponized anthrax, right after 9/11. It got out, and we know that the doctor who came down, the first SARS patient, happened to be working in a Chinese communist biological warfare laboratory. So a second example of these things getting out, why would you be making a new and deadly diseases with the potential of them getting out, unless, of course, well, why would you do that? It's totally illogical. So you have to be prepared. I don't know what the future holds, but I do know we're living in very uncertain times, and you're going to have to be making the preparations, as Cal has said, to be able to function in society and look after yourself and your family. And with food and supplies and means of getting potable water and the various other things you need, medical supplies, what would you need if you couldn't get down to the hospital to the local store to get what you need? Well, Cal, we've got a minute or two. Would you like to just sort of wrap up the program?
Yes, I wanted to tell a little bit about my new company. Of course, business is growing, and I've got a name for my business now. Of course, it's called the Gold and Silver Exchange. The Gold and Silver Exchange, and I've added an associate. His name is Glenn Parker. He's with me, so when you hear my message on my phone, you'll hear that. And it's kind of exciting because there's a tremendous market now for gold and silver, and people are starting to pay attention. And one of my main concerns is that, you know, we don't have a panic here, because in 1980 that's what happened. And in the middle of a panic, everybody gets stampeded, and not too many people get what they want. So I hope gold slows down a little bit. I don't really want to see a panic. And $500 an ounce is kind of like a psychology number. When it gets there, people will, I think, start a buying frenzy. And
well, I think it'll get their attention anyway. We're out of time, Cal. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you, and we'll look forward to talking to you again perhaps later this month. Good night.
Thank you, Doctor.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Cal Grunwald. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. And, of course, we will, of course, try to talk to you about preparation. We'll try to talk to you about the medical issues. We'll try to talk to you about history and what's really happening. But let me just point out at this time that there are secret societies in our working behind the scenes. These secret societies do have an agenda. I cover those in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and they all have one thing in common. They may compete for leadership and power, but they all are intent upon creating a world government and, of course, destroying Christianity. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or seen our video of the Secrets of the Illuminati or the Brotherhood of Darkness, it's all the same story. It just gives you the background of what's really happening today. And certainly we would encourage you to check out the facts. We hope you'll want to go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You'll actually can pull down our newsletters and read them too, although we are putting those into booklets, and we have a three booklet series on what happened on 9-1-1 with information you won't get elsewhere. But it's called Foreknowledge 9-1-1, Part 1, Part 2, and Part 3. We put together a booklet on genetic engineering and population control that does go into vaccines. A section on a booklet entitled We Are a Republic. And then lastly, the booklet on the history of money, which will give you the background of how we got into the situation we are, and an understanding of the spiritual forces behind the monetary system that really dominates our society today. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are spiritual forces behind what's going on today. You really can't understand anything unless you understand we're fighting a spiritual battle on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. So please go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs on the Internet 5 hours a day, either directly or indirectly on the Genesis Network, GCNLive.com, or the American Freedom Network, that's AmericanNewsNet.com. Encourage others to listen to the programs to get an education, an overview, an understanding of what is really taking place in the world today. Because I can only reach a certain number of people, but you can reach them. You can explain to them what's going on. And don't be surprised if a lot of people don't want to listen to what you have to say. Because for too long, our minds have been molded, our ideas suggested, our tastes formed largely by men we have never heard of. Those are the words of Edward Bernays, and yet they're so true today. Most of what the average American knows just isn't true. And your job is at least to try to get them to think, to try to get them to realize that the media is largely controlled. Remember, you'll always get a lot more information by asking questions than you will by giving lectures. So try to get people to think, try to get them to listen to our programs, and let me convince them. And then we ask you, of course, to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.